Chapter 48. And I give the man credit for it. Elizabeth Jane was amazed at the intelligence. Joke? Oh no, she cried. And he kept you from me, father, all those months, when you might have been here. The father admitted that such was the case. He ought not to have done it, said Farfrae. Elizabeth sighed. Said I would never forget him. But oh, I think I ought to forget him now. Newson, like a good many rovers and sojourners among strange men and strange moralities, failed to perceive the enormity of Henchard's crime, notwithstanding that he himself had been the chief sufferer therefrom. Indeed, the attack upon the absent culprit waxing serious, he began to take Henchard's part. Well, 'twas not 10 words that he said, after all, Newson pleaded. And how could he know that I should be such a simpleton, as to believe him? 'Twas as much my fault as his, poor fellow. No, said Elizabeth Jane firmly, in her revulsion of feeling. He knew your disposition, you always were so trusting. Father, I've heard my mother say so hundreds of times, and he did it to wrong you. After weaning me from you these 5 years, by saying he was my father, he should not have done this. Thus they conversed. And there was nobody to set before Elizabeth any extenuation of the absent one's deceit. Even had he been present, Henchard might scarce have pleaded it, so little did he value himself or his good name. Well, well, never mind, it is all over and past, said Newson good-naturedly. Ah, about this wedding again. 44. Meanwhile, the man of their talk had pursued his solitary way eastward till weariness overtook him, and he looked about for a place of rest. His heart was so exacerbated at parting from the girl that he could not face an inn, or even a household of the most humble kind, and entering a field he lay down under a wheatrick, feeling no want of food. The very heaviness of his soul caused him to sleep profoundly. The bright autumn sun shining into his eyes across the stubble awoke him the next morning early. He opened his basket and ate for his breakfast what he had packed for his supper, and in doing so overhauled the remainder of his kit. Although everything he brought necessitated carriage at his own back, he had secreted among his tools a few of Elizabeth Jane's cast-off belongings, in the shape of gloves, shoes, a scrap of her handwriting, and the like, and in his pocket he carried a curl of her hair. Having looked at these things, he closed them up again, and went onward. During 5 consecutive days Henchard's rush basket rode along upon his shoulder between the highway hedges, the new yellow of the rushes catching the eye of an occasional field laborer as he glanced through the quickset, together with the wayfarer's hat and head, and downturned face, over which the twig shadows moved in endless procession. It now became apparent that the direction of his journey was Wagdon Priors, which he reached on the afternoon of the 6th day. The renowned hill whereon the annual fair had been held for so many generations was now bare of human beings, and almost of aught besides. A few sheep grazed thereabout, but these ran off when Henchard halted upon the summit. He deposited his basket upon the turf, and looked about with sad curiosity, till he discovered the road by which his wife and himself had entered on the upland so memorable to both, 25 years before. Yes, we came up that way, he said, after ascertaining his bearings. He was carrying the baby, and I was reading a ballet sheet. Then we crossed about here, she so sad and weary, and I speaking to her hardly at all, because of my cursed pride and mortification at being poor. Then we saw the tent, that must have stood more this way. He walked to another spot, it was not really where the tent had stood, but it seemed so to him. Here we went in, and here we sat down. I faced this way. Then I drank, and committed my crime. It must have been just on that very pixie ring that she was standing when she said her last words to me, before going off with him. I can hear their sound now, and the sound of her sobs. Oh, Mike! I've lived with thee all this while, and had nothing but temper. Now I'm no more to thee, I'll try my luck elsewhere. apostrophe, he experienced not only the bitterness of a man who finds, in looking back upon an ambitious course, that what he has sacrificed in sentiment was worth as much as what he has gained in substance, but the superadded bitterness of seeing his very recantation nullified. He had been sorry for all this long ago, but his attempts to replace ambition by love had been as fully foiled as his ambition itself. His wronged wife had foiled him by a fraud so grandly simple as to be almost a virtue. It was an odd sequence that out of all this tampering with social law came that flower of nature, Elizabeth. Part of his wish to wash his hands of life arose from his perception of its contrarious inconsistencies of nature's jaunty readiness to support unorthodox social principles. He intended to go on from this place visited as an act of penance into another part of the country altogether. But he could not help thinking of Elizabeth, and the quarter of the horizon in which he lived. Out of this, it happened that the centrifugal tendency imparted by weariness of the world was counteracted by the centripetal influence of his love for his stepdaughter. As a consequence, instead of following a straight course, yet further away from Casterbridge, Henchard gradually, almost unconsciously, deflected from that right line of his first intention, till, by degrees, his wandering, like that of the Canadian woodsman, became part of a circle of which Casterbridge formed the center. In ascending any particular hill, he ascertained the bearings as nearly as he could by means of the sun, moon, or stars, and settled in his mind the exact direction in which Casterbridge and Elizabeth Jane lay. Sneering at himself for his weakness, he, yet every hour, nay, every few minutes, conjectured her actions for the time being, her sitting down and rising up, her goings and comings, till thought of Newson's and Farfrae's counter-influence would pass like a cold blast over a pool, and efface her image. And then he would say to himself, "Oh, you fool! All this about a daughter who is no daughter of thine." At length he obtained employment at his own occupation of hay trusser, work of that sort being in demand at this autumn time. The scene of his hiring was a pastoral farm near the old western highway, whose course was the channel of all such communications as passed between the busy centers of novelty and the remote Wessex boroughs. He had chosen the neighborhood of this artery from a sense that, situated here, though at a distance of 50 miles, he was virtually nearer to her whose welfare was so dear than he would be at a roadless spot only half as remote. And thus Henchard found himself again on the precise standing which he had occupied a quarter of a century before. Externally there was nothing to hinder his making another start on the upward slope, and by his new lights achieving higher things than his soul in its half-formed state had been able to accomplish. But the ingenious machinery contrived by the gods for reducing human possibilities of amelioration to a minimum which arranges that wisdom to do, shall come pari passu with the departure of zest for doing stood in the way of all that. He had no wish to make an arena a second time of a world that had become a mere painted scene to him. Very often, as his hay knife crunched down among the sweet-smelling grassy stems, he would survey mankind, and say to himself, "Colon here, and everywhere be folk dying before their time like frosted leaves, though wanted by their families, the country, and the world, while I, an outcast, an encumberer of the ground, wanted by nobody, and despised by all, live on against my will." He often kept an eager ear upon the conversation of those who passed along the road, not from a general curiosity by any means, but in the hope that among these travelers between Casterbridge and London some would, sooner or later, speak of the former place. The distance, however, was too great to lend much probability to his desire, and the highest result of his attention to wayside words was that he did indeed hear the name Casterbridge uttered one day by the driver of a road wagon. Henchard ran to the gate of the field he worked in, and hailed the speaker, who was a stranger. "Yes, I've come from there, maester," he said, in answer to Henchard's inquiry. "Trade up and down, ye know, So, what with this traveling without horses that's getting so common, my work will soon be done. Anything moving in the old place, may I ask? All the same as usual. I've heard that Mr. Farfrey, the late mayor, is thinking of getting married. Now is that true or not? I couldn't say for the life o' me. Oh no, I should think not. But yes, John, you forget, said a woman inside the wagon tilt. Had were them packages we carried there at the beginning o' the week? Surely they said a wedding was coming off soon on Martin's Day? The man declared he remembered nothing about it, and the wagon went on jangling over the hill. Henchard was convinced that the woman's memory served her well. The date was an extremely probable one, there being no reason for delay on either side. He might, for that matter, write and inquire of Elizabeth, but his instinct for sequestration had made the course difficult. Yet before he left her, as he had said that for him to be absent from her wedding was not as she wished it to be. The remembrance would continually revive in him now that it was not Elizabeth and Farfrey who had driven him away from them, but his own haughty sense that his presence was no longer desired. He had assumed the return of Newson without absolute proof that the captain meant to return, still less that Elizabeth Jane would welcome him, and with no proof whatever that, if he did return, he would stay. What if he had been mistaken in his views? If there had been no necessity that his own absolute separation from her he loved should be involved in these untoward incidents? To make one more attempt to be near her, to go back, to see her, to plead his cause before her, to ask forgiveness for his fraud, to endeavor strenuously to hold his own in her love, it was worth the risk of repulse, of life itself. But how to initiate this reversal of all his former resolves without causing husband and wife to despise him for his inconsistency was a question which made him tremble and brood. He cut and cut his trusses 2 days more, and then he concluded his hesitancies by a sudden reckless determination to go to the wedding festivity. Neither writing nor message would be expected of him. As he had regretted his decision, to be absent his unanticipated presence would fill the little unsatisfied corner that would probably have place in her just heart without him. To intrude as little of his personality as possible upon a gay event with which that personality could show nothing in keeping, he decided not to make his appearance till evening, when stiffness would have worn off, and a gentle wish to let bygones be bygones would exercise its sway in all hearts. He started on foot 2 mornings before St. Martin's tide, allowing himself about 16 miles to perform for each of the 3 days' journey, reckoning the wedding day as one. There were only 2 towns, Melchester and Shottsford, of any importance along his course, and at the latter he stopped on the second night, not only to rest, but to prepare himself for the next evening. Possessing no clothes, but the working suit he stood in now stained and distorted by their 2 months of hard usage, he entered a shop to make some purchases which should put him, externally at any rate, a little in harmony with the prevailing tone of the morrow. A rough yet respectable coat and hat, a new shirt and neckcloth, were the chief of these, and having satisfied himself that in appearance at least he would not now offend her, he proceeded to the more interesting particular of buying her some present. What should that present be? He walked up and down the street, regarding dubiously the display in the shop windows, from a gloomy sense that what he might most like to give her would be beyond his miserable pocket. At length a caged goldfinch met his eye. The cage was a plain and small one, the shop humble, and on inquiry he concluded he could afford the modest sum asked. A sheet of newspaper was tied round the little creature's wire prison, and with the wrapped-up cage in his hand, Henchard sought a lodging for the night. Next day he set out upon the last stage, and was soon within the district which had been his dealing ground in bygone years. Part of the distance he travelled by carrier, seating himself in the darkest corner at the back of that trader's van, and as the other passengers, mainly women going short journeys, mounted and alighted in front of Henchard, they talked over much local news, not the least portion of this being the wedding then in course of celebration at the town they were nearing. It appeared from their accounts that the town band had been hired for the evening party, and, lest the convivial instincts of that body should get the better of their skill, the further step had been taken of engaging the string band from Budmouth, so that there would be a reserve of harmony to fall back upon in case of need. He heard, however, but few particulars beyond those known to him already, the incident of the deepest interest on the journey being the soft pealing of the Casterbridge bells, which reached the traveler's ears while the van paused on the top of Yalbury Hill to have the drag lowered. The time was just after 12 o'clock. Those notes were a signal that all had gone well, that there. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.